people that are on X, if you're scrolling through X and you see, hey, this guy's doing this and he did this, and why can't I do it? Where before, with me growing up, like I said, I knew one uncle that was an entrepreneur. That was it. So just the idea of becoming one was hard. But now I feel like there's so many examples, and the examples are real, and the path is really open to anybody. And I feel like the more people see that, the more people are going to choose it, because I want to trade it for the world.
Welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, where we speak with voices shaping the real estate industry, entrepreneurship, and our world. On today's podcast, we speak with Gabe Treviso, an appraiser, serial entrepreneur, and Shark Tank success story. On the podcast, we dive into the life of a serial entrepreneur, how to succeed and still have a work-life balance, what Shark Tank is like behind the scenes, and strategies to effectively bring multiple products to market. For entrepreneurs, today's episode is well worth a listen. Gabe, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Gordon.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Gabe?
Sure. My name is Gabe. I'm an entrepreneur in spirit. I live in Gilbert, Arizona. I have a wife who I met in eighth grade. So long history with her. We have four awesome little kids, ranging from 6 to 13. And I'm just like a lot of your listeners, I'm sure. I'm just a normal guy that just likes to do a lot of different things. So I find myself curious about a lot of different avenues. I own a handful of businesses in a bunch of different fields. And I just like to stay busy. I like to learn. I like to do things like this and just kind of talk with other entrepreneurs and just grow and learn and network and do all the fun stuff that we get to do.
What did you do in a previous life? Because I've seen you talk about teaching content and educational content on your Twitter. And I think that's originally how I got in touch with you.
Okay. No, I mean, my background is in real estate, really. I mean, I graduated from Arizona State, played college baseball, graduated from ASU, and didn't know what I wanted to do. So I fell into real estate appraising, and I've done that the last 17 years. Started a firm, grew that, and along the way started a few different companies and different avenues. My wife's a teacher. We homeschool our kids, so she does the majority of that. So that might be what you're referencing. Yeah, man, that's kind of my background.
And so, what do you think inspired that entrepreneurial spirit in you starting off? Do you think it was innate, or did you have a mentor along the way?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think a lot of it is innate. I mean, I had an upbringing, middle class upbringing, but I always had this drive to solve problems uniquely. So whether that was like, creating bug sprays growing up, or trying to figure out trinkets that might fix something I was struggling with, turning Legos into something that they're not supposed to be. Those kind of things I did. But so I don't know. And then I had an uncle who, he had that same kind of spirit. But as a kid growing up with him in my life, I just felt like, I don't know, I felt like it was out of reach. I don't know why I just felt that, but as I grew and learned and developed, and my entrepreneur journey started a little bit later, because in all reality, I fell into real estate appraising, and that turned into a company. So in a way, it's entrepreneurship, but that's more like small business leadership driven work. But I always had the itch to create, and I think my first step of that was our product Suds to Go, which I invented, created, developed, and we took it on the Shark Tank. So, I mean, that was kind of the beginning of like, oh, wow, you really can do this. And since then I've been, that's just a few short years ago, but it's opened up the world to me as far as like creating and launching new products and not being afraid to take those chances, which has been awesome.
I know we're going to come back to Shark Tank, but
Where do you think that gap was that originally gave you pause with exploring the entrepreneurship path? Because I think there are a lot of people that might be listening to the podcast right now, or a lot of people that are Twitter followers of mine that don't want to take that leap. Where do you think that gap was?
Man, I think it's a gap of like, I think the gap lies in confidence, right? I think the idea is that a lot of listeners might have is that like, hey, like this guy is an expert, or this guy has it all put together. Like he knew what he was going to do before he did it. And that's really not it at all. I mean, the journey is the journey and the process, right? And you learn so much through it that you've never done before. It's just a matter of like taking that step and being willing to take that chance, right? I mean, that's the gap, is really just doing.
Let's talk about what you did by getting on Shark Tank. So how does that Shark Tank process work in the first place? Did you reach out to them? How did it all start?
You know, rewind a little bit. I was, you know, my wife and I, we were big Shark Tank fans. So even before I was on Shark Tank, obviously as a creative person, Shark Tank was on my radar. I loved it. I watched every episode. I watched it when I could. When I created Subs to Go, you know, we had lots of people saying, hey, that'd be a great Shark Tank product. You should be on Shark Tank. You should go on Shark Tank. And obviously, you know, that was on the radar. And interesting enough, like we created an Instagram page for our product. The product was doing well. And this, I mean, actually back up a little bit. We created an Instagram page for our product while we were developing it to kind of show you the process of developing. That time I reached out to the Shark Tank's casting director on Instagram. And she was responsive and we talked and she's like, well, it's, you know, you're early. You know, we'll keep in touch kind of thing. And I was like, oh man, that stinks. And I was too early because we didn't even have product. It was more of just like, hey, I have a prototype. And she's like, yeah, no, that's not gonna work. Fast forward, you know, a year or 9 months later, now we have a ton of product because we've gone through the process of developing, ordering, manufacturing, delivering it. And that just happened to launch right at the front of COVID. So, you know, bringing a mobile hand washing system to the market when COVID's hitting, it was dumb luck. It was just timing. So it took off. And at that point it was selling so fast, Shark Tank wasn't on our minds at all. It was more of just like, how are we going to fulfill this order, the demand? And at that point, you know, they reached out via DM, same lady, hey, have you applied for this season coming up? And I'm like, no, we haven't, you know, I'm just been too crazy. And she's like, well, you should. So we did, of course we did. And then, you know, we went through the process. It's like a 3 or 4 step process. You do an application, you sign your life away, you sign a bunch of papers that's like 8 inches thick. I didn't read all of it, obviously. And then you go through the process and they interview you and then you do like videos. And then they interview you some more and then the executive producer interviews you and then you kind of, then they decide. So for us, it was a little different. We had to go to Vegas because it was still in the middle of COVID when we pitched. So what Shark Tank did was they created a bubble at the Venetian in Vegas.
Not a bad place to hang out.
Right. And this is the coolest part. We were quarantined at the Venetian. They gave us like a suite, just my wife and I. And we were there for like 8 days, man. They had to test us. They tested us like 3 or 4 times for COVID. And we just had this nice suite at the Venetian for 7 or 8 days together. And in between there, we pitched to the Sharks. So it was cool.
And so you go through the pitch process. We only see on TV like 5-10 minutes. Yeah. How does that process actually work in real life? Because as somebody who works with folks that do PE and venture capital, like a pitch usually is a little bit longer than like a 5-minute pitch. So what's it like in real life?
Yeah. So the truth is the Sharks have no idea who you are or your company is before you walk in. Now, obviously prior when we submit our paperwork, they ask all our financials, we have to include all that. So that if you do get a deal, they have that packet ready to give to your investor. And they're very clear, like, hey, when the doors go open and you walk down that hallway, like, if you mess up, like, don't stop. There's no, like, restart. It's almost like they're hoping for you to, like, screw up for their good TV. You know? So that's all they told us. You know, they told us, hey, like, you stand on the, you stand, you hit the X, you stand on the X, cameras are going to zoom around you. And then we're going to yell, like, 3, 2, 1, start pitch. And if you mess up, just start it all over. Like, don't just stop, because we're just going to keep airing it. That's all they told us. And the reality is, you do that and you do the whole intro, you do your whole skit, which is like a minute, 20 seconds or whatever. And then you end it. And what you don't see on TV is, like, it really is chaotic. The sharks, they're all individually microphoned. So, like, when you watch it on TV, you're like, oh, it seems pretty docile and quiet, and, like, it organized. And that's not how it is. Like, they're talking over each other. They're, like, arguing with one another. You're answering one question to one shark over here, and another one's asking another question over here. And it's way more chaotic. And I think we were in there for just under an hour, maybe 50, 60 minutes. Yeah. And they crunched it down to 9 minutes. But as far as, like, them knowing you before you walk in, there's none of that. It's not scripted. The pitch is completely edited. You know, there's a lot of cutting and pasting of, like, hey, well, I said that, but I didn't say it to that question. Like, there's a lot of that going on, but yeah, man, it's a mixture of real life and reality TV.
Well, that's interesting to hear. I have a friend who was on The Bachelor, and, like, he's like, I'm not that terrible. I'm not that terrible. Yeah. And so it's always funny to hear reality TV and what it actually is in reality, right? So a lot of people talk about the reality of that Shark Tank has value, right? A lot of value. What ultimately was the value that you found getting out of Shark Tank? Because some people talk about, you know, it's great working with Robert or Mr. Wonderful or Mark Cuban. Or some people talk about the network or the views just for being on Shark Tank. I mean, my wife and I watch. Yeah. What was, you know, the value that you got out of Shark Tank?
Yeah, I mean, going on Shark Tank, I think there's a misconception of, like, hey, these companies that go on Shark Tank and they get a deal, they've made it. Like, even, like, for me, I was like, you know, once we get there, we've made it. And that's not the truth at all. I mean, the biggest value of Shark Tank, you know, we got a deal with Robert. We closed the deal with Robert. Not the same deal that was on TV, but, you know, we closed the deal. I think that the real value of Shark Tank, though, is obviously the exposure for your company. I mean, you know, that's number one. Number two is definitely the network of entrepreneurs. It's a lot like X. Like, I've learned that, you know, on X, the last few months, I put a lot of time into networking and trying to grow my network and meet guys and meet people and just help people. And just, like, the whole network on X, if you put the effort into, will grow the same way. But with Shark Tank, one of the greatest things has been the network. And it's cool because there's a private Facebook group for just all the entrepreneurs who have stood on that carpet. So you had to have aired on Shark Tank to be in this group.
And it's a pretty selective group. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's cool. And so you can go in there, ask questions. You can say, hey, does anybody have a good lead for this? Or, hey, has anybody worked with this Amazon company? You know, is it worth it? So there's a lot of value there. And I think those two things are the biggest value add is, one, obviously exposure for your company. Two, the network of entrepreneurs is top notch.
Going through and understanding that entrepreneurship process, though, because, you know, you're a busy guy, and we only have so many hours in the day. Let's kind of break into just talking about entrepreneurship in general. So one of the things that I know you've talked about on Twitter, and part of, you know, talking about homeschooling and all sorts of things about how I originally discovered you, but why I actually followed you was because you were talking a lot about kind of the concept of going to market and kind of the process from taking that pioneering idea to bringing it to market. So how do you go about the process of taking an idea to market? I know that that's a super large topic to take on, but I think it's one of the fascinating things about folks that are multiple time entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think, so with Suds2Go, I had zero product background. I had zero marketing background. You know, I had a real estate background. But so I've learned through the process, right? So I guess to bring a product to market, like what's the best way to do it? I think obviously the first step would be trying to determine what kind of market demand is for it. There's different ways you can do that. I mean, you know, you can create, depending on what it is, you can create prototypes. You can 3D print prototypes. You can share those with people to see what the feedback is. You know, not friends and family, but I'm talking about like strangers and just being a little bold and being out there and walk up to where your product might fit, whether that's a playground or parking lot or wherever it is, and just say, hey, what do you think about this? If someone's in need of what you're selling, that's a great way to do it. Once you determine if there's a market demand, you know, then the next steps then would be dealing with industrial engineers, designers that are going to create the product to where it's manufacturable, you know, because there's other, you know, you might have an idea and it might be great, but if they can't manufacture it, then it's not going to work. So there's that side of it. And once you have that done, then they design the CAD files and then you go to manufacturers, most likely in China, unfortunately, but, you know, that's where stuff's made. And then from there, you just have to make sure that, hey, like, this is what it's going to cost to make it, and this is what I can sell it for, and the margins have to make sense. And you got to factor in marketing, shipping, fulfillment, all the costs that you don't really think about, right? You think, hey, I can sell it for this. I make it for this. I'm going to like this amount. Not how it works. So, you know, what I've learned, though, since Suzago, as far as bringing products to market, is it's awesome to have partners, you know. I don't know if you've seen, I just posted today that I'm launching a popcorn spray. And I just today I got the first, you can see it right behind my head. I got the first bottle samples of Popcorn Perfect. And that I'm doing with the manufacturer partner. So he does the manufacturing, I do the branding creatives. In this way, it's been so much easier than just doing it by myself and learning as I go. So I think a lot of it is learning. A lot of it is, hey, like finding somebody who's done it, reaching out to them and saying, hey, you know, do you like this? Like, would you be willing to help me? Like, there's a lot of that too, because people want to help. And I get a lot of DMs from people who send ideas that they have and say, hey, what do you think about this? Or like, in, I'm such a curious entrepreneur, so I'm always looking, and I'll give people honest feedback. And I'm excited for people. So, I mean, that's, you just got to take those steps and go for it. I mean, that's, we only got one life, so you got to go for it.
I can't speak to it as an entrepreneur, of course, especially to your level, but just what I found generally on Twitter in terms of investors in the real estate world, is people are incredibly open, particularly when you're not directly competing with them, to go and give you ideas and help. And sometimes you don't even have to pay that consultant to come in and take a look at something. Someone will just, you know, give you a little bit of insight, particularly for an exchange of ideas. And so to anybody who is listening on the podcast, just reach out, DM that person. And the worst thing that can happen is sometimes they'll not respond. So in terms of that, I'm just curious. I know you talked about building businesses, and I know you started out in the real estate world. What would you say is the biggest difference you found between building like a real estate business, because we have a lot of real estate listeners, and a product-based business? Because I think they are vastly different, and I find sometimes the personality traits that allow a service-based business to succeed can be vastly different than the product-based business. So two successful businesses in completely different spheres make you a pretty interesting person, Gabe.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. I think service business, my appraisal business, is very client relationship-based. So, I mean, a lot of the characteristics obviously overlap. I mean, you got to have good communication skills. You have to be able to service your clients, customers well. You need to be able to listen to their needs well, and you have to be able to do what you say. I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, if you know, what sets you apart in any kind of business is like doing what you say. You know, if you say you're going to deliver something on the third of next, or on the Monday of next week, then you need to deliver it on Monday of next week. That's how it works. If you do that and you have quality, whatever you're selling, whether it's an appraisal or if it's a Suds to Go bottle, if you're meeting expectations or exceeding them, then you're going to succeed in business. Ultimately, I think that's what it boils down to. And that's probably the most, you know, common elements of product and service. There's a lot of differences, you know, obviously. Product business, there's a lot more about like, hey, what does branding look like? You know, what does it look like? How are you going to attract the buyers? Where are you going to find them? Where my service business, not so much. My service business has grown organically through relationships, and that's different than product.
Talking about organic growth, how do you manage your time in terms of trying to grow all these businesses at the same time? Because I see a lot of people who are entrepreneurs, they try to do it through social media or to scale their time. How are you getting that process to allow all sorts of different businesses to grow at the same time?
Yeah, I think I have to, and this is probably not the thing I'm best at because I'm very much a creative mind. I'd probably say that I have a little bit of ADD in me. So I have a lot of, you know, irons in the fire. I like doing a lot of things. What I've learned recently though is I've hired some assistants offshore that are kind of handling a lot of stuff that I don't need to handle. And I've learned that from X, that like, and through meeting other entrepreneurs similar to me, that it's super important to buy back your time. If you can pay someone to do something that you're doing and it might cost, you know, whatever it is, dollars per hour, then do that instead of wasting your time doing it. And so I feel like I'm at the beginning of that journey. And I'm excited about the prospect and what it looks like so far. But to answer your question, you know, I don't have a super good answer other than I focus a lot of my time on whatever business is making me the most money and try to streamline that business. And then the other businesses, I work on them. You know, I might have two or three projects for each of them that I'm working on. And then those projects are replaced as I knock them out. So the focus isn't as much as my appraisal company gets, because my appraisal company has employees that rely on it. I mean, it just has more history of like client relationships I have to deal with daily. So I just have to prioritize, you know, which business and what I'm doing.
So how do you ultimately do that priority? Is it just return on investment to time? Because a business that might be at an early stage of development might require a lot of time, but be making no money, versus a business that's at a later stage, you might be making a lot of money, but not require as much time. How do you end up making that time priority?
Yeah, I mean, I have X amount of hours per day I can work. So whatever's on my plate of things I have to get done, starting with my appraisal company that day, because the appraisal company has legitimate deadlines. So I have legitimate assignments that are due. All my other companies have checklists of things I have to get done. But if I don't get it done today, it's going to be there tomorrow. It just delays progress, which I hate. But ultimately, I deal with deadlines first. And then from there, I go to what's next most important at whatever business is needing what. So there's not really a clear answer other than I focus on things I have to get done and then move to things I'd like to get done and need to get done for the other businesses.
So the thing that really originally drew me to your account was you talked a lot about intentional fatherhood. And I'm a father, got a very young kid, but still a father, and managing time is very challenging, right? I mean, yeah. Like, besides the fact that every morning when I wake up, you know, at 6 a.m., he's awake, and I went from being a night owl who worked late into the night to being a morning person like that. in terms of that, how do you manage your time as a dad? Because it's a challenge for a lot of folks, and you seem to be doing it quite well with several kids and several companies.
Yeah, I think for me, I was very specific when I started my companies. Like I have hard times. Like, so I have like 5 o'clock, I'm done. So at night, and that doesn't mean I won't. I mean, my phone is still like, you know, China is opposite of us. So if I'm doing something with China, I'm doing it at night. I try to do it after they go to bed, but like, let's say 5 o'clock, I'm done working with my appraisal company. I work from my home, so I have like a detached little guest house. I run my appraisal company out of that, so I can see my house right now. At 5 o'clock, at the latest, I walk over there. I'm done with my appraisal company. I don't answer phones, emails, nothing with my appraisal stuff. I wake up early. I come in at 5 every morning, and I'll do whatever is important. So if that's appraisal work, I'll do it. If it's subs to go work, I'll do it. If it's my other business stuff, I'll do it in the morning. Walk back over there at 7:30, hang out with them, have breakfast, come back over here at 8:39, work till 5. Sometimes I'll go over there for lunch if I'm home. And then weekends I don't work. I mean, I've made it a habit to like just not do that. You know, like that time's theirs, and I don't wanna steal that from them. So weekends, no work, no go. After 5, no go. And then whatever, and then, you know, Monday through Friday during my work time is just all go, you know, as hard as I can.
Going through that process and talking about all go, one of the things that I think you've done about as successfully as anybody we've had on is branding. And when you're doing that process, how do you focus on kind of developing strong brands for your product and then maintaining them? Because I think that's something that a lot of our listeners who are kind of in the early stages of entrepreneurship are really kind of focused on looking at.
Yeah, I mean, branding's interesting. It's obviously not something that my background's in. I ask a lot of questions. You know, I share it with a lot of people, friends and not friends, just to get honest feedback, and I take that to heart and I adjust if I need to. I don't know. I just feel like branding is, I've always been pretty good at developing names. Naming is something I've been pretty good at. And then from there, design and logo and stuff, I just rely heavily on designers and what they do well. And then I pick and I help them change it if need to be or whatnot. But, yeah, branding is kind of one of those things where, you know, I'm good at developing names and names for product, catchy names. But as far as like design, logo, it's more of just hiring the right designers and then having an eye for something that stands out for me and then believing in it, you know?
Going along with that, how do you know product's good? Like you mentioned believing in it, but like, when is it right to believe in a product, or when is it right to just say, maybe this isn't the one? How do you know something is a market fit?
Well, you know, with Suds to Go, we didn't know, because that's a novel product. There wasn't anything like it. We patented it. I have the utility patent for it. So that was a brand new product. I just knew for us at that time, leading up to Suds to Go, I'd always had ideas. I'd share them with my wife and she would say, "That's stupid. No, don't, that's dumb." But when I shared Suds to Go with her, she's like, "I would buy it." So, I mean, that was the start of like giving me confidence of like, well, here's a woman who's has kids and like, that'd be the target customer. And she says she would use it. So from there, I took the idea to people similar to her. I ran polls on Facebook. I paid for some ads cheaply to see if anyone was interested in this cheap landing page that I built with the concept on it. And people were. So that was kind of like the driving force of Suds to Go. Now with the other products that we're launching, specifically Popcorn Perfect, and then we're launching another product too with the same partner. You know, he's a manufacturer, so he knows who's filling what cans and the how many. Because that's what he does. So his whole thing is like, hey, there's a huge demand for this. You're good at branding. Let's do it together. And that makes it a lot easier because I feel like the market research is done. We know the demand's there. Now it's just a matter of branding better than your competitor. And since my partner's manufacturer, we can beat them on price too. So that's the plan with those new products.
And for a food brand, could you tell us a little bit more about that? Because food is something that we have a lot of listeners that are in the food industry. Chicago is a big food town. Mm-hmm. Besides Deep Dish Pizza, we have some pretty large food brands that are headquartered in the Midwest. And curious to learn a little bit more about the new launch.
Yeah, so we're launching a popcorn spray, basically like a buttery flavored popcorn spray. Honestly, I'm not a big popcorn fan, not something that I eat. But when my partner came to me and said, hey, there's one competitor, they don't do it very well. And they sell a lot of popcorn spray bought cans. I'm like, okay, well, that sounds like an opportunity. So then we look at it and say, hey, okay, what can we do? What would it look like? And we go for it. I've never been in food. This is like a spray. I mean, it's not like salsa or something that has to sit on a shelf, that has a shelf life. It does have a shelf life, but nothing like, not months or even weeks, so it's learning. It's a learning environment for me too. But it's a challenge, and I like that. And I know it's a good opportunity, and I'm confident in me, and I'm confident in Ryan. And I feel like, the environment's ripe for us to come in and disrupt that little bit of competition that we have.
So talking about disruption, how do you know when a product is underperforming? You mentioned that, that their product might be underperforming in the market. What was the indicators that led you to believe that this was a niche that you could jump on?
Well, you're right. I mean, if you look at their numbers, they're not underperforming. I mean, they're doing very, very well. Now they don't have competition. So at that standpoint of, which for me is a big bullseye, because it's like, okay, you got this product that's doing very well. There's nobody else competing against them. And then from there, you look at their branding, right? You look at what they're selling and how they're selling it. And from there, we saw an opportunity. I wouldn't say they're underperforming. They're doing really good. It's just a matter of we would like some of that pie too.
In terms of that pie, I'd like to circle back as we get kind of near the end of the podcast to talk about the real estate pie. That's, of course, one of the biggest reasons why we brought you on, besides all your success, is that you have a unique look at the world from both the entrepreneurship and the real estate sector. So what would you say that you would say is the biggest difference between working in that service industry and growing your real estate business? Because your appraisal business is incredibly successful. What have you applied in the real estate world from entrepreneurship?
I think doing things different. I think that's would probably be the biggest thing. I know a lot of appraisal companies and a lot of appraisers are single man shops. They don't want to teach. They don't want to add new appraisers. They don't want to, they don't want to bring in competition. And I've looked at it differently. I've trained 7 appraisers now. Four of them still work in my company. But I've just looked at it more out of like the mindset of abundance than trying to keep all for me. So I think that's a good way to apply it. I mean, I think entrepreneurs in general are the type of people who do things differently. And I think that's cool. Like I pride myself on being different. And I've applied that to what I do and with my businesses.
And where do you think that abundance mindset ultimately comes from? Because there's so many folks in the real estate business that don't have the abundance mindset, brokers and developers, that they spend half their day just trying to keep other people out versus trying to build and develop new products or improve their services. Where do you think ultimately that comes from? And do you think there's a chance that we could have more of that in the real estate industry going forward? Or are we, you know, destined to?
I think guys that, I mean, I don't want to speak in generalities, but I think people who have an abundance mindset enjoy competition. Like, I don't think, I'm not worried about, you know, I'm not necessarily worried about one of my trainees taking my business, right? I mean, because I feel like I have a system, I have relationships at work. And it's not my job to like keep them from their own success either. So I don't know, you know, what the exact right answer is for that. I just think I don't focus on like who's coming up behind me. I focus on what's ahead of me and what I can accomplish, you know, through my own hard work and efforts. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And if people need help, you know, I have a few guys that I trained that went on to start their own companies, and one of them's still a very good friend. And he calls me 3 times a week saying, hey, you know, what should I do here? Or, hey, what should I do here? Or, what would you do in this situation? And I'm more than willing to help him because, one, he's a friend, and two, why not?
So you mentioned training. Before we get to the end of the podcast, how do you train folks in the real estate business? Because I think one of the biggest gaps we see, at least from the firm and development and management perspective, is poor training. How did you develop those processes, and how did you train a team of, you know, 7 appraisers? It's, you know, it's a pretty large team for the appraisal business.
Yeah, it is. You have to be super intentional at the beginning with them. Cause in all reality, they're all college educated people, but it's a different language, you know, it's a new language than them. Everything's new. So it's a lot of patience. It's, you know, it's 3 steps backwards to take a step forward. And you have to be willing to do that investment for the company. The last one I've trained was prior to my new companies. So then I had a lot more time to do that. It'd be quite a bit more difficult now to do it because I have other stuff that's occupying whatever extra time I have. I guess the answer to you is, I think it's, you just have to be super intentional, patient, and willing to like know that your business is going to struggle for 6 months. But, you know, knowing that investment's going to, you know, you're going to take 5 steps forward in months 7 through 18 or whatever it is, because you have this new person that's pulling the same direction as you for your company.
You talked about time there. We're getting to the end of our time. But we have the final 4 coming up, and that's kind of our roundup where we get a really unique perspective on the way you think. We try to bring on some of the more unique thinkers in the real estate world and the world of entrepreneurship. And, we'd like to give you 4 quick questions that kind of, you know, help us learn a little bit more about you and to give us a better perspective on the world. So the first one is one of my favorites. And it's, where do you see entrepreneurship going in general over the next 10 years? Because I think you have a unique perspective, being somebody who's been at the Shark Tank level, has started their own businesses. Where do you think the world's going in terms of entrepreneurship?
I think it's going to grow. Like, I really do think that as a society and as a culture that's more connected than ever, I think opportunities, and examples, you know, are seen more frequently from people. So in other words, I think people that aren't X, if you're scrolling through X and you see, hey, this guy's doing this and he did this, and, you know, why can't I do it? Where before, with me growing up, like I said, I knew one uncle that was an entrepreneur. That was it. You know, so just the idea of becoming one was hard. But now I feel like there's so many examples, and the examples are real, and the path is really open to anybody. And I feel like the more people see that, the more people are going to choose it, because I want to trade it for the world.
The world is so flat. It's so much flatter than it was. I'm a millennial. I'm almost 35, which is relatively young, you know, for the world. But even within my short life, the world has flattened so much. it's hard to imagine that won't get a little flatter. In terms of that, I wanted to follow up with one quick thing. You talked about entrepreneurship and the evolution there. Do you think real estate will evolve a little bit more? Because that is, in so many ways, one of the most antiquated industries around. Do you think that entrepreneurship vibe will start to come more into the real estate community, or will it be a last holdout and kind of the antiquity of, you know, doing business?
No, I think it will. I mean, I think there's definitely just some disruptions coming into the real estate world. I have crazy ideas I think would work, but I know there's people out there that are working on ideas within residential, at least. That's where I live. And I'm sure with commercial too. I just don't know. I don't know that as well, but yeah, I definitely think that within 10 years, real estate transactions and the way they process are going to look way differently.
Yeah, we've certainly had a number of folks on the podcast already doing that. So we're not going to get into that. But what we will get into is looking at, you know, a young Gabe. So in terms of if you could travel back in time now, I know we just went forward, but if you go back to high school Gabe, what would you tell yourself?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I would tell myself to buy Bitcoin. For sure.
It's not the first time we've heard that.
Yeah, no, that's right. In all reality, though, I think I would tell myself not to waste time. You know, like, I feel like I wasted years because I didn't really start being serious about life and my career until I was 28, 29, you know, and then I was like, I better really look at taking this world on. So I feel like that's one regret, is not starting earlier. I have good friends in one of my ex groups, and the kid's like 23 and just crushing it. And I'm like, man, you are going to be a stud in another 50 years. You know what I mean? Like, that's cool. So I think that'd be my advice to young Gabe: Bitcoin and start earlier.
I think that's great advice. One of the ways that folks on the podcast, as well as just in general life, like to reach out and understand a little bit more about the world is through books. And so we've had some great book recommendations. What would be a book that, if we have a young entrepreneur who wants to reach out into the world and you know, grasp a little bit more information, what book would you recommend?
You got me on that, man. I'm not a huge reader, surprisingly. I have such limited time that reading is like for the beach when I'm there.
Look, I feel the same way. I'm a big audiobooks guy personally. As a broker, you know, we drive around and we see a wide range of properties, and it can be audio, it could be a podcast.
I think it doesn't
have to be this podcast, by the way. So
I think the most recent one that was referred to me that's on my list is The Buy Back Your Time. Have you heard of that book?
I have, yeah.
By Dan Martell. Yeah, that's kind of the one that's on my list. If the next book I read will be that one, because the person who referred that to me is somebody who I really respect. So I'm like, yeah, I probably should read that. So that's next.
So you can buy back your time and then you can read another book, right? With all the time.
There you go.
Now we have one last question that's the absolute critical one that I won't let you get out of. And it's the whole reason for the podcast. What I found is on X and, you know, on LinkedIn, the most important resource is connections and connecting people with people that have incredible ideas, right? And so the whole reason why we created the podcast is to reach out to folks in the arena, men in the arena who are doing incredible things, and they tend to know people who are doing equally incredible things that we haven't been exposed to yet. And so I'm curious, who should be the next person that we reach out to?
Ooh, I got a list of guys you can reach out to. I think depending on what you're looking for, Alex Purcell, who's a laundromat guy. That'd be a really good guess for you guys. Who else would be a good one? I have to look at my here at my X, but the problem is I have a group of guys on X who I love to death, and all of them would be an awesome guest for you. Alex Forbes, he's the cabinet guy. I don't know if you follow Alex. Shannon Jean, another guy who's awesome. Shannon's really cool because he's super experienced as an entrepreneur, and he has unique perspectives into a lot of niche ways to make money. So Shannon has a really cool perspective on stuff. Parker Cox, I don't know if you know him. He has Pavago, which is an offshore staffing agency. Super smart guy. Who else? Dan Magazzo is a guy that I was telling you about, who's a young kid who's just an awesome entrepreneur in a mind. He'd be cool to have on. I mean, there's a lot. Mike Higgins. I mean, there's a lot of dudes on X that you should talk to. And I just ran through pretty much my closest group of guys there, but all would be worthy.
Well, we'd love to have them on, but there's one question that we're going to ask you before you go. And that's, what's the best way that if somebody wants to reach out to you, that they can get in touch?
I think through DMs on X is probably best. That's the easiest. If they have any questions or want to reach out, that'd be a great place. And if anyone has any questions, especially about, you know, products or entrepreneurship in general, you know, I'm more than open to speaking to them or spending a little time offering anything I can offer to them.
Gabe, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today. And we have to have you on again and hear a little bit more about your perfect pop.
Yeah, that'd be cool, man. Thanks, Gordon.
Thanks again to Gabe. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a follow, or a review. Your subscriptions and interactions truly matter and help us continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.